last week, Jerry closed with a great cliffhanger where he said, you know, it's not fair to compare Maimonides and Spinoza because the science is so much more advanced in Spinoza's day. But we're going to see that something even more interesting than just a comparison occurs here. So I want to, without much further ado, jump in to really the kind of the key movement Maimonides makes, which is nothing less than a tectonic shift in what the Torah is and what we are doing when we read it and live it. But I have to say a little bit about the content. So we're going to actually do a very similar source sheet to what we did yesterday in the afterlife, but with a different focus. Yesterday, the topic was the afterlife and great heroes, Maimonides. Today, the topic is the Maimonidean role of the metaphor, the role of the metaphor for Maimonides. And the context in which Maimonides develops this is in his articulation of the afterlife. So we have to talk a little bit about it. But we don't need to talk too much about it. But the thing I want you to see here, which is interesting, is that Maimonides is placing the afterlife not as a question of kind of the intrinsic nature of the cosmos, if that makes sense, not like what is the nature of human existence. But you'll see he actually places it as a subset of the question of reward and punishment. Right? What good do human beings expect? So one interesting way that those framings diverge is if you make the afterlife fundamentally a question of metaphysics, you would be equally concerned with where human souls come from before they're born, right? Because you're actually trying to give an account of how a human soul, you know, moves through its body. Whereas if your concern is with reward and punishment, you may not care about where we came from. That's much less important or differently important than where we're going. And you could have versions of reward and punishment that make the claim, as, you know, Chazal often do, that there is reward and punishment in this world. They also often deny that claim. But that is the framing that Maimonides gives. And we will take it away. Okay.
Great. Section one from Sanhedrin, Mishnah Commentary, Sanhedrin 10. I must speak now of the great fundamental principles of our faith. Know that the masters of Torah hold differing opinions concerning the good which will come to a person as a result of fulfilling the commandments which God commanded us through Moses, our teacher. As a consequence of their different understanding of the problem, they also hold widely different opinions concerning the evil which the transgressor suffers. So much confusion has invaded their opinions that it is almost impossible to find anyone whose opinion is uncontaminated by error.
Let's just pause for a second. So my mom is describing the state of play is chaos. People believe totally different things. I will give you an analogy to throw a little Israel politics fuel on the fire, because why not? You know, if you read Aviezer Ravitsky's amazing book, in Hebrew it's like Case of Megula, in English I think it's called Zionism, Messianism, and Jewish Religious Radicalism. We should all log off the call right now and go read it. Ravitsky details how there is a group of anti-Zionists led by the Munkacher Rebbe, who is actually the Satmar Rebbe's Rebbe, who believes that Zionism is the state of Israel is nothing less than demonic in the full sense. Then on the other side, there's a school led by Tzvi Yehuda Cook and his followers who believe that the state of Israel is nothing less than intrinsically holy, every action and every tank. And then the Lithuanian Thomas Gleich has a story, the famous story of Chaim Soloveitchik, who with a Brisker yeshiva moved to Jerusalem. And there was a man on the street, a religious man, talking about how terrible Zionism was, and he spit on the ground. And Chaim Brisker said, that man's a Zionist. What do you mean? He was just saying how terrible Zionism is. Religiously. He said, Zionism is the belief that Zionism is significant. That man believes that Zionism is significant, and he's a Zionist. I believe Zionism is of zero significance. Right? So it's like in like the same moment in, you know, 1940, actually, this is demonic. This is intrinsically sacred, and this is of zero significance. Plus all the other people who are like, oh, this is great, this is exciting. It's neither demonic, nor nothing, nor interesting, you know. And just to give you a picture, that's similar to what my mind is saying. Total chaos, complete divergence. Okay, so now we'll see. Actually, this is a much smaller degree of chaos than that, but you should read Ravitsky's book. It's really good. Okay.
One group thinks that the expected good is the Garden of Eden, a place in which one eats and drinks without any physical work or effort. They also believe that there, houses are made of precious stones, beds of silk, rivers flow with wine and fragrant oils, and many other things of that sort. This group believes that the evil is Gehenna, a place of raging fire, in which bodies are burned and agonies of all sorts are inflicted upon men. Their descriptions of these afflictions are told at a great length. This group adduces proof for their opinions from the words of our sages and from passages in the scripture whose literal meaning seems either wholly or largely compatible with what they said.
Great. So, and just to be clear, my audience is going to do this as he signaled for each group. They give a positive version and a negative version. What's the reward and what's the punishment? Carve out. So here we go. Gan Eden, something like heaven in an embodied way. You know, it's just really nice. Like vacation. And hell, which is like really unpleasant. Okay. Let's go on to group number two.
A second group asserts that the good for which we hope is the days of the Messiah, in whose time all men will be angels and all of them will live forever. They will be giants in stature and will grow in number and strength until they have occupied the entire world forever. The Messiah will, with the help of God, live forever. They also believe that in those days, the earth will bring forth garments woven, bread baked, and many other impossible things. In this view, the evil is that a man may not be alive in those days and may not merit the privilege of seeing them. This group also adduces proof from many statements found in the writings of our sages and from biblical verses, whose literal meaning seems to agree either wholly or partly with what they said.
Great, messianic era, very nice. Now, one thing that's important to note, I'll say two things on this. The first is, this is the basic meaning of Olam Haba. Right, the original meaning of olam in Hebrew is not world, but epoch, E-P-O-C-H, or era. And olam haba is the next era of world history. And I'll leave this. And Shama Friedman actually has an article about how you can kind of see in the encounter with Greek that there's not really an analog to cosmos. Even olam gets forced into that use also. I'm sure maybe Yakum would have been better, but whatever. That's point number one. And anyway, I saw your chat request. That's it's a very fun idea. My favorite book. That's yeah. That's a cool list. Maybe I'll try to come up with something for next week. I can't promise, but I'll try. The second thing is just to share with you: the bread baked is actually the majority of the line Hamotzi Lechem Min Haaretz. The bracha, God who brings forth bread from the earth. Now, bread does not come from the earth, right? They've noticed. It's in fact impossible. Minority sit here. So the minority opinion in Bereishit Rabba is that we're referring to the bread that exists before us, and we're kind of shortcutting or erasing the human labor, etc., that goes from getting wheat into bread. But the majority opinion is that we're actually imagining, each time we say hamotzi, the bread that will come forth in the future fully baked from the earth, which is kind of an amazing idea. There's a kind of a redemptive anticipation in each bracha. I didn't want to not share that. Okay, so that's group number two. Now, okay, so group number one, right? Gan Eden, there'll be a specific place where you go, there'll be like vacation. Group number two, the world will be transformed. And here, there's not really suffering. It's just like, I'm sorry, you missed out. You lived too early. Bummer. It's like, oh, is that fair, really? It's like, everyone in a certain time is good. Everyone in a certain time is good. Okay, there's problems, but it is what it is. Okay, third group.
A third group holds that the good for which we hope is the resurrection of the dead. By this, they mean that a man will live after his death and return to his family and dear ones to eat and drink and never die again. According to this opinion, the evil is that a man may not live after his death among those who are resurrected. Here, too, proof is deduced from many sayings that are found in the words of the sages and from biblical verses, whose literal meaning seemed to teach this wholly or in part.
Right. And so Ariana asked an interesting question here about the first group, right? Do we believe we go to the Garden of Eden or Gehenna when we die? The Rambam doesn't make that explicit. Is it now or is it, you know, in some future time? You know, interestingly, elsewhere, I think here, the Rambam says actually believes that the Garden of Eden is a spot on the earth, which contains many amazing plants, which will have great medicinal purposes. And I always wondered, like, what happened to that idea in the Jewish world when, like, the whole world had been mapped? So I think Maimonides says this is a future thing, but it's not clear. You could imagine different subversions of group one. I think that's going to be the key thing for Maimonides. As you'll see in a minute, when we get to group five, I think his feelings about how seriously to take your question will change in an interesting and productive way. Okay.
A fourth view holds that the goal of fulfilling the commandments is the achievement of bodily peace and mundane success, like fertile lands, extensive possessions, many children, health, peace, and security. They also believe that there will be a Jewish king who will rule over those who oppressed us. The evil that will overtake us if we deny the Torah is the opposite of these, as in our present exile. Those who hold this opinion likewise find support for their views in verses of Torah, particularly the curses, and from other passages in scripture.
It's like literally the whole book of Deuteronomy. That's the fourth. And again, here, this is now interesting, like the time frame, which Ariana also asked a question about. This could happen now. This could actually be a description of the present, right? As in our present exile, right? This one is very much of this world. Awesome. Okay. But now we get to group five, which is my favorite group.
A fifth group, the largest one, combines the opinions of all the others. They assert that the ultimate hope is that the Messiah will come, that he will resurrect the dead, who will enter the Garden of Eden, where they will eat and drink in perfect health forever.
Right, just mash up. Why not have it all? Why stop with one? So just if you could turn off the screen share for a second. You know, I titled this section the Maimonidean Claim of Incoherence, because in some ways the key, the kicker is the end of each passage, where he says, you know, and this group adduces many proofs from scriptural and Talmudic passages, which is accurate. Yes, thank you, Sherry. That's the one. Because what Maimonides is saying, I just want you to see here, is he's actually made a very, very, very strong claim, which is that you cannot produce a coherent picture of the world to come or reward and punishment just reading the sources of the Bible and the Talmud. Does that make sense? There is sufficient evidence for multiple conflicting, incompatible views. Do we, you know, just take the evil column at some point. Do you stay dead? Do you get transported or resurrected in Gehenna? Do you just miss out? You know, et cetera? Do you live in exile? You can't really have all of those. And yet there are verses and agadot that support them all. And so the Rambam is making like a really, really, really important claim, which is that if you try to reconcile, to create a coherent account of the Torah's dogma of the hereafter, you will fail. Okay? Now, this is not quite, it's not actually anything like a claim that these accounts are right or wrong. I mean, he tossed in that impossible about, you know, clothes coming forth from the earth, and, you know, just the right size and color for you. One of these could be possible. This is not a correspondence picture, a correspondence series of truth. Does this idea map onto the world? This is not a correspondence claim my body has made. It's an internal coherence thing, right? That's a different picture of truth claims, right? Often you'll talk about internal coherence. The problem with the internal coherence series of truth generally is that, you know, if you're totally paranoid, you have a totally coherent picture. The world's wrong. You know, you can't just use coherence as a criteria. But Maimonides has made a strong and correct claim, and we'll look at one of these inside, because it's very sweet. But just to see here that there's something really, really significant here, that Maimonides is saying, if you take all of these statements as factual statements about the present, about the past, about fate, you can't, if you take that project seriously. You can't do it. You won't succeed. You know, I remember one time when I was actually in Rabbi Shai Held's class at JTS, Rabbi Held said something similar about Rav Soloveitchik's writing on prayer. He said, I don't encourage you, he said, I strongly discourage you in your final paper from trying to write a synthetic account of Rav Soloveitchik's thought on prayer. You will fail and you will get a bad grade because it can't be done. Right? That's not how he was writing. It's like Kierkegaard. I know people know about this. Kierkegaard, you know, he never published books in his own name. He would put, I'm sorry, I'm just reaching over. I just unpacked my computer here in front of my office here. He would publish them under different names because the idea was he wasn't trying to advance one theory. Yeah, what he was trying to do is he was ironically putting on different personas and trying out different voices. And so if they conflicted, it wasn't a problem because none of them, they weren't Kierkegaard. Right? They were really playing different characters in different movies. Let's do this. Max, you want to keep reading? You're doing such a great job.
The school of Eliyahu taught, "The righteous whom the Holy Blessed One will resurrect do not return to their dust, as it says, and it shall be that he who remains in Zion, or who remains in Jerusalem, shall be called holy, anyone who is written unto life in Jerusalem." Isaiah chapter 4, verse 3. "Just as the Holy One exists forever, so too will they exist forever. And if you say, during those years when the Holy Blessed One will renew the world, as it says, and the Lord alone shall be exalted on that day," Isaiah 2:11, "what are they doing? The Holy Blessed One will make them wings like eagles, and they will fly over the surface of the water, as it says, so we will not fear when the land is replaced, when the mountains crumble into the sea. And if you say they will suffer," the verse teaches, "but they who wait for the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings as eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not tire."
Great. So the account here is the righteous will be resurrected and live forever, which is a little bit of a mashup of two of those. Great. You know, we can even say it's very interesting. The Talmudic passages may anticipate some of these questions Maimonides was asking what happens and say, oh, they'll be resurrected and then live forever. And then it says, we actually do a little bit of reconciliation here. We say, okay, well, what about we have this other Agadah that God will renew? I would, you know, think a new homeowner here, I would say renovate the world. Right? It seems like God's going to kind of bash the world into a watery existence and then reform it. So what are they going to do? You're going to have these eternally living human beings with no world to live on. So God will give them wings. And then you're like, hey, they're going to get tired. And then say, oh no, God will give them energy. So this is, I jokingly said yesterday, this is like God will give them jetpacks. They will zoom around over this watery surface. It's like water world or something, right? That's an amazing image. So, okay, so that's one picture of what's going to happen. So now just scroll down a little bit. We'll get this wild, very tiny Agadah. So, Max, if you would read the Babli Shema.
Okay. Rav Mari said, "In the future, the righteous will be dust, as it says, and the dust return to the earth as it was."
Well, there you go. They're just going to be dust. This is, I mentioned this yesterday, an amazing statement. It's quoted zero times, classical Jewish tradition, because it's seen as heretical or at least depressing. So they won't, there's no afterlife. Okay, what do you do with these? I mean, it couldn't be more different. But now one that I think is even funner, if you will. So Naomi, do you want to pick up here with Rishi Rabba? We'll go back into my mind. So I just, you know, we want to do some of what he's up to here. Okay, so this is an amazing one. Okay.
God said, "I will wipe out humanity." Rabbi Levi said,
"There's a double entendre in the Hebrew. Normally, we don't have to look at Hebrew here, right? Vayomer Hashem, I should emcha et ha'adam. So ha'adam could be humanity, but it also could be Adam, like primordial Adam, the guy, you know, with Eve. Okay, and now we'll see how that gets played out."
Rabbi Levi said, "In the name of Rabbi Yochanan, even the ball of the millstone was wiped out." Rabbi Yehuda.
So this is like the hardest thing. Because, right, the millstone is these two very hard stones that are, you know, the meats run through them, right? So that even the hardest stuff in the world, obsidian, diamond, whatever's at the top of your most hardest scale, is obliterated by the floodwaters. Okay, great. Of Noah. Terrific.
Rabbi Yehuda Bar Rabbi Simon said, "In the name of Rabbi Yochanan, even the dust of primordial Adam will be wiped out." When Rabbi Yehuda expounded this in public in Sepphoris, they did not accept it from him.
Rabbi, so I just want to point this out. It's an amazing moment. So Rabbi Yehuda stands up and he gives a Devar Torah in Sipori in northern Israel. And he says the dust of Adam was completely annihilated in the flood. And the people hated it. Right? It's actually an amazing moment. You're like, the rabbi's servant went over badly. And we'll kind of maybe start to see why. Okay. You can see the confusion about the state here of Adam. Okay, let's keep going.
Rabbi Yochanan said, "In the name of Rabbi Shimon ben Yehotzadak, even the base vertebra of the spine for from it, God saw that in the future, humanity would be wiped out.
I'm sorry. I've told this translation on Safari, and it's actually so bad. I just need to correct you here. The he sees here is not saw. Oh, this is so bad. I need to go ahead and correct it there. It's not this. From which God would cause humans to re-sprout what is like that. Okay, that's better. He seats there is to flourish, not to see. It's a bad translation. So the base vertebrate in the coccyx, Adam's coccyx, was annihilated. Okay?
Adrianus, may his bones rot, asked Rabbi Yehoshua ben Hananya. He said to him, from where did the Holy Blessed One make humanity re-sprout in the future? He said to him.
So Adrianus is asking, how does God resurrect it? We need a mechanism. Okay, we're about to see it.
He said to him, from the base vertebra of the spine. He said to him, from where do you know this? He said to him, he brought it to me, and I am telling you.
He said, bring it to me. I will say, I'm sorry, I don't know what this person was supposed to have to go to. Okay. So this is now, it's Rabbi Yochanan saying to Rabbi Yeshua ben Hananya saying to Adrianus, bring me one, bring me a coccyx, and I'll show you. So here's what happens.
They grinded it with millstone, and it was not grinded. They burnt it with fire, and it was not burnt. They put it in water, and it was not wiped out. They put it on a block and began to strike it with a hammer, and the block split, and the hammer broke, and it was not missing anything.
So amazing. So it turns out that there's an indestructible part of your body, your coccyx, and that is what, it's like Jurassic Park. Like, that's where the DNA is going to come from to resurrect you, your coccyx. And we know here that it's totally indestructible. And this is probably what the people in Sipori thought, which is why they didn't like Rabbi Yehuda's Devar Torah, that Adam was entirely annihilated. But just because on this count, so one is interesting. It seems to grant there's some kind of naturalistic basis for resurrection. There needs to be something left of a human being that's recognizable. Be resurrected, not like that, a Whitman quote? Yeah, it looks, if you want me, look under the soles of your boots. Now when I'm gone, give my flexing at ease. Your coccyx will be there. So with this picture, at least according to one version, Adam is entirely annihilated, and therefore he cannot and will not be resurrected. Now let's scroll to this amazing, amazing Agadah. And this is the practice, just in the background, you know, is that there's the practice in Eretz Yisrael of marking out graves and cemeteries so Kohanim would not accidentally pass over them and become impure. And that is the conduct, and the graves were often underground and had different configurations depending on the cave, which is what they mostly used. Grave digging was really hard before hydraulic presses. You know, they would have to be kind of marked out in different configurations. Okay, Naomi, take it away.
Bana'a used to mark out caves where there were dead bodies. When he came to the cave of Avraham, he found Eliezer, the servant of Abraham, standing at the entrance. He said to him, what is Abraham doing? He replied, he is sleeping in the arms of Sarah, and she is looking fondly at his head. He said, go and tell him that Bana'a is standing at the entrance. Said Abraham to him, let him enter. It is well known that there is no passion in this world. So he went in, surveyed the cave, and came out again.
Let's just pause for a second. So Rabbi Bana'a is walking around, you know, we're circa the year, I don't know, 200. And he comes to the cave of Avraham, which is usually not described as Ma'arat HaMachpelah here. That's how we normally refer to it. And it turns out that Eliezer, Avraham's servant, is still alive and kicking. He's the doorman. And so Rabbi Bana'a says, I need to come in. This is the first amazing thing, he's having a conversation with Eliezer. Unreal. So then he says, you know, what's going on? And there he says, they're cuddling. Very sweet scene. And so he's like, well, can you tell them to kind of separate so that it's not awkward when I walk in? Right? He doesn't want to. It's like, you know, like it. So Avraham shouts out from the cave. He's like, don't you know that everything is platonic in the afterlife? We're just cuddling. Like, you know, there's nothing to worry. He won't see anything embarrassing. So he goes in and he measures. So this is an amazing scene. But it turns out, right, the picture is that at least in the future, Eliezer's alive and Avraham can talk and he and Sarah are still together in some sense. It's wonderful. Okay, now let's keep going.
When he came to the cave of Adam, a voice came forth from heaven saying, "You have beholden the likeness of my likeness. My likeness itself may not behold." But he said, "I want to mark out the cave. The measurement of the inner one is the same as that of the outer one," came the answer. Those who hold that there was one chamber above another say that the answer was, "The measurement of the lower one is the same as that of the upper one."
Is there a cage of, above or in one inside the other? But it doesn't matter. The voice is like, "You don't need to go in and see. I'll just tell you where the corpse of Adam is and block it off. So you don't need to go look. You're done." Okay.
Rav Bana'a said, "I discerned his, Adam's, two heels, and they were like two orbs of the sun."
So here, and if you could turn off the screen, thank you, Naomi, you read that well. So here, you know, okay, let's just get back to where we were. We had a 180 degree complete disagreement up above about whether Adam is dust or dust plus a coccyx versus just completely annihilated, right? We thought those were as different as they could become. Turns out there's another opinion. If you go into the right cave in the hills south of Jerusalem, you'll encounter a light, a blinding light emanating from Adam's heels. And the picture is, if you saw the radiance of his face, it would be enough to destroy you, as God said, "You know, my likeness, mighty Adam." Well, that's quite different. Doesn't seem like he's been obliterated. Doesn't seem like he's maybe even of a substance that can be obliterated. I didn't, you know, we didn't have anything before about radiance. It's just very, like, what are we supposed to make of all this? By the way, we didn't see in any of our positions from Maimonides above that you might live out eternity in a cave in a kind of undead embrace with your beloved and with your household staff waiting on you, talking to mortals. Right, that was not one of the four opinions, and it wasn't included, therefore, in the mashup number five. Right, so I just want to see, Maimonides is like, he's so right. Right, I mean, this is just, I mean, okay, but what do you do with that? Great, okay, so what we just had was three different groups where you had a question posed to them: what does Judaism say about the hereafter? What happens? Now, Maimonides, continue, we're back in the same section of the commentary on Parakhilek, is going to give us a different question, three different ways of reading Agadah. What do you make of the text that we just looked at, the text? Okay, and now we're going to see him, watch him go. Okay.
"You must know that the words of the sages are differently interpreted by three groups of people. The first group is the largest one. I have observed them, read their books, and heard about them. They accept the teachings of the sages in their simple, literal sense and do not think that these teachings contain any hidden meaning at all. They believe that all sorts of impossible things must be. They hold such opinions because they have not understood science and are far from having acquired knowledge. They possess no perfection which would rouse them to insight from within, nor have they found anyone else to stimulate them to profounder understanding. They therefore believe that the sages intended no more in their carefully emphatic and straightforward utterances than they themselves are able to understand with inadequate knowledge. They understand the teachings of the sages only in their literal sense, in spite of the fact that some of their teachings, when taken literally, seem so fantastic and irrational that if one were to repeat them literally, even to the uneducated, let alone sophisticated scholars, their amazement would prompt them to ask how anyone in the world could believe such things true, much less edifying. The members of this group are poor in knowledge. One can only regret their folly. Their very effort to honor and to exalt the sage sin, accordance with their own meager understanding, actually humiliates them. As God lives, this group destroys the glory, for he said in his perfect Torah, the nation of a wise and understanding people. But this group expounds the laws and the teachings of our sages in such a way that when the other peoples hear them, they say that this little people is foolish and ignoble. The worst offenders are preachers who preach and expound to the masses what they themselves do not understand. Would that they keep silent about what they do not know. As it is written, if only they would be utterly silent, it would be accounted to them as wisdom. Or they might at least say, we do not understand what our sages intended in this statement, and we do not know how to explain it. But they believe they do understand, and they vigorously expound to the people what they think rather than what the sages really said. They therefore give lectures to the people on the tractate Berachot and on this present chapter and other texts, expounding them word for word according to their literal meaning.
Beautifully right. So if you could pause there. So this group, and Andrew, if you could turn off the screen share. So this, my audience does not like this. So let's just discuss how they operate. And I want to point out, it was a little bit of a throwaway at the beginning, but it'll become critical in the next paragraph. Maimonides says, I'm familiar with them. I've read their books and heard their words. So this group says, okay, we've seen this many times, right? It says in the Torah, God has a body, therefore God has a body. It says in the Talmud that Eliezer is still talking to people in the hills of Hebron. Therefore, Eliezer is still talking to people in the hills of Hebron. Like, just boom, boom. And so my mind is like, first of all, you should be embarrassed to say such a thing with a straight face. We've talked about this, the different values versions of it. It's pedagogic, which is, oh, the Torah says I should own slaves. I guess I should own slaves, right? Yeah, so you shouldn't say that with a straight face. You'd be like, well, what do I do? And then my mind is a very nice move, which is people may be familiar with from Rabbi Ethan Tucker's teachings in a halachic register, but he does it first in an agadic register, here, a values register, theological register, where he says, Deuteronomy says that if you're doing the Torah right, the other nations of the world will look at you and say, what a wise and understanding people. He says, but Jews say this idiotic crap that says Judaism teaches this, and other people look at us and they're like, these people are dumb, and they have a backwards culture. And you're actually not honoring God, you're denigrating God. You think you're honoring God. And these people lack, right? They have not achieved perplexity. They haven't gotten to the point of being distressed by all, right? That's his picture. and then he says something which is, you know, kind of nice to me. And he says, look, okay, but my thesis is really with these people. If you like don't have, yes, God is exactly. And the Talmud also. The Talmud and the Torah here are really contiguous, not contiguous, they're non-distinguished in Maimonides' thinking, you know, I think rightly, both in his hermeneutic method of reading them, but also in the problematic context. You know, I said, okay, look, if you don't have an education and you're just faithfully following your teachers, that's one thing. But the buck stops somewhere. You know, someone teaching has responsibility. It's like the theological version of that joke, like if you're not a Reconstructionist, well, then your posake is. Maimonides is saying something, right? Like, someone has freedom there. Someone has responsibility. Maimonides says something similar theologically, right? Like, this, okay, there's responsibility really primarily in the leadership. So that's group one, okay? They read reality off of the text, and it doesn't go very well for them. Okay. Now, Jerry, I want you to read, if you're up for it, group number two, because this is directly follows on our exchange at the end of the last discussion.
The second group is also a numerous one. It too consists of persons who, having read or heard the words of the sages, understand them according to their simple literal sense and believe that the sages intended nothing else than what may be learned from their literal interpretation. Inevitably, they ultimately declare the sages to be fools, hold them up to contempt, and slander what does not deserve to be slandered. They imagine that their own intelligence is of a higher order than that of the sages, and that the sages were simpletons who suffered from inferior intelligence. The members of this group are so pretentiously stupid that they never can attain genuine wisdom. Most of these who have stumbled into this error are involved with medicine or astrology. They regard themselves as cultivated men or women, scientists, critics, and philosophers. How remote they are from true humanity compared to real philosophers. They are more stupid than the first group. Many of them are simply fools. This is an accursed group because they attempt to refute men of established greatness whose wisdom has been demonstrated to competent men of science. If these fools had worked at science hard enough to know how to write accurately about theology and similar subjects, both for the masses and for the educated, and if they understood the relevance of philosophy, then they would be in a position to understand whether the sages were in fact wise or not, and the real meaning of their teachings would have been clear to them.
Okay, great. It really was. So scroll up a little bit. So now let's characterize this group, and we'll say a little bit about this group, Flatnagar. Okay, so this group agrees with Maimonides. Agrees with the first group, as Maimonides says, right? According to their simple literal sense. So that's actually a shared assumption between group one and two, that the genre of the Agadah is theology textbook, history textbook, theology textbook, you know, claims, factual claims. Okay. Now, and are they new atheists? We'll get to that. They're actually the old atheists. Okay. And then they say, well, this stuff is nonsense. This is heresy. This is so dumb, right? Who needs this? Right? Okay. So these two groups, this isn't clear, you know, if you've been thinking this, you should feel great about yourself. So I'll say it. Right? These two groups are the groups that take that different directions of the perplexity from the very beginning of the guy. Right? These are the two groups. One says, oh, it says in the Torah, God has a body, therefore God has a body. The other one says, it says in the Torah, God has a body, but God doesn't have a body, there, peace out, guys. Right? These are the just this exact same position. And what's amazing is Maimonides wrote this when he was 25. He wrote the guide when he was about 55. He wrote, and you can see that the basic problem is actually identical throughout his life. Okay. And there's a scorn here. There's a mocking, which I think was part of what led Ezra to suggest the new atheists, right? They look down on the rabbis. And now look at how Maimonides describes them, which is really interesting, right? They tend to be involved in what we would call the hard science, right? Astrology counted as a hard science. Right, medicine. But what they don't know is if they had worked at science, you know, hard enough to know how to write accurately about theology and similar subjects, both for the masses and the educated. This is an element now of rhetoric. And in the better translation, you're probably, if they understood the practical parts of philosophy, not the relevant philosophy, but the practical pieces of philosophy, what you might call arete, the craft, right, the praxis, then they would be in a position to understand whether the sages were in fact wise or not, and the real meanings of their teachings would be clear. And so what Maimonides is saying is that the second group is people who are so enamored with the hard sciences and so ignorant of the humanities that they think what they're seeing is science when it's not. It's literature. So now, I mentioned earlier, and Jerry, this is coming at you for the end of last time, right? Maimonides does not say the anti-vax movement. Wow. Yeah, we know more, right? So Maimonides does not say he has read these people's books or heard their sermons or even met them. I'm going to give you a little bit of a parallel, which because I'm about to make a wild claim, but I need to try to motivate it. So Andrew, if you could turn off the screen share. So Sarah Strumser, in her great book, Maimonides in His World, which I recommend very highly, does something very interesting. She is in a totally different context, but you'll see how she brings it over here. In the laws of Shchita, kosher slaughter, someone, a heretic, cannot slaughter kosher meat, right? You have to be of a proper belief, and this is what leads David Berger, the historian at UCB University, who studied how Jews martyred themselves, to argue that Chabad messianist meat cannot be eaten by other Jews, because they are, in fact, in the technical sense, Christians, because they believe that there is a messianic individual human being. What makes Berger so upset about this is, right, his heroes are the Jews who gave their lives rather than accept such a belief in Europe, and now he sees Jews freely embracing it in Berlin. So that's the context. So in the commentary on the Mishnah, Maimonides gives a definition of heretic. And what Strumser points out, as I forget which chapter this is in the book, is that his definition of heresy does not draw on any of the classical Jewish sources. But it actually reads a lot like a man who was executed in Baghdad in the 9th century for heresy. Very interesting. I mean, and think about the scholar, like what you need as a scholar to be able to like make such an observation. Amazing. And so Strumser is, you know, kind of pointing out to us that Maimonides, when he's kind of reporting things, he's not just an innocent reporter. He's creating. Okay, why am I telling you this? So Strumsa then makes the following claim on this passage. She says, you know, that first group, the people who take the Bible and the Talmud and its stories literally, and we have many documents. We have books, sermons, we have pamphlets, we have letters, etc. They're well documented. The second group of Jews who scorn the Talmud because of its fantastical things. So, you know, something that's remarkable is that there is no such person and there is no such statement in the literary tradition preserved from Roman antiquity, the Muslim world. They're just, what Maimonides has done here is extremely the suggestion, and this is why I'm thinking of you, Jerry, is that Maimonides has invented Spinoza. Right? In order to have map out the conceptual terrain, there are people he knows of who take it literally and say stupid things. He says, you can also imagine people who know science well enough and don't know rhetoric well and don't appreciate literature, and so they reject this whole enterprise. And even though no such person has existed, Maimonides can imagine such a person and does, and writes Spinoza into existence. And so part of what's so amazing about this for me is that then when you see Spinoza's commentary looking back on Guide 225, what you are seeing is a time warp of about 500 years as these two men look at each other. Does that make sense? In Guide 225, in the commentary in TTB, the Theological Tractatus Theological Politico, Spinoza said, in 225, Maimonides, Guide 225, Maimonides recognized that the Torah says the things that aren't true. But he insisted that we read the Torah in this weird way that isn't just about the literal meaning of the words, but about forcing it into like some kind of thing we could endorse as true. You can't do that, Spinoza says. Because Maimonides recognized it's not a good book, but he then circled back to it in a new way that I can't endorse. And Maimonides 500 years earlier says, you can imagine someone who will say this isn't a very good book, but they leave things there. And they don't understand that the art of being a strong reader is of making something new out of it. I mean, it's kind of incredible to see. And so, Jerry, this is why I didn't want to accept the idea that Spinoza and Maimonides are somehow determined by the progress of science in their times. But actually, and I'll say a little bit, I want to kind of fully absorb this, so I'll say a little bit about, there is another perplexity about the progress of science in Maimonides' time, which is very interesting, which Strumsa talks about well. But I just want you to feel this here, that Maimonides and Spinoza are so well, it's like watching fighters, like they're circling each other in a ring, right? Like they know each other, and they can inhabit each other's head, and they're here opposed to each other. But each one kind of defines the other. It's like a good hero and villain, right? Like one of them can't really exist without the other. And, well, we'll get to Maimonides. But I just wanted to pause there because I think it's such a remarkable thing to see these two, and they're like twins in a certain way. It's like Harry and Voldemort. I don't want to say which one is Harry, which one is Voldemort. But you can't extract them from one another, right? Okay, just want to pause here and see if people have like comments or reactions at this stage. Oh, good. How would my mom even read that? Oh, good question. Good question. Or an allegory or containing story. So what do you do? What do you do, right? So you have some bad, just like with the guide, right? We have some bad options out there, you know, the two kind of obvious ones with them. But what are the good options? So I just want to, before we do that, Ariana, I'm going to ask you to read section, the third paragraph here, the third group. But I do want to tell you about this other type of perplexity because it's actually totally fascinating. Wait, don't turn on the screen share yet. We're not there yet. Ready yet? Strumsa talked about this and other people have as well. So Maimonides, okay. Oof, we're going a little bit like outside of my expertise here, but I want to share it because I think I can summarize it accurately. So, okay. So there's an Aristotelian cosmology, right, which is the earth at the center and the seven heavens, 10 heavens, how many circles you need. And the way you deal with retrograde motion, sometimes stars with this way or that way, is you have different spheres that are moving. And everything moves in spheres because that's perfect. And then there's Ptolemy and Ptolemaic astronomy, which is about either things moving in ellipses or epicycles, where it's moving in a circle, like how the earth, how the moon moves around the sun, right, where it's moving in a circle around. The Earth is going in a circle around the sun, and then the Moon is going in a circle around something going on that circle, right? It's kind of like ellipses. And what Maimonides describes, the great perplexity, actually this is an early in section two of the guide, is the following, is that Ptolemaic astronomy, with its ellipses or its epicycles, can predict the timing of eclipses down to the second. And this is an advance in 12th century astronomy. And Aristotelian cosmology cannot. But Aristotelian cosmology is theoretically coherent and grounded, and Ptolemaic astronomy does not have any empirical basis for it. I'm sorry, any theoretical basis for it. And would not even have a coherent formulation until you get Kepler's laws of motion, and then finally Newton's theory of universal gravitation. It would be the first time you have a theoretical grounding for the mechanisms of Ptolemaic astronomy. And Maimonides says this is the great perplexity. Actually, it's totally fascinating. And then he says, interestingly, if you told Aristotle about this, he wouldn't have believed you. He would have yelled and run the other way. It's one of the few times when he criticizes Aristotle's character. So I just wanted to share in terms of the progress. It's really fascinating in the progress of science, right? To see this moment of it's like almost the ceiling, right? Structure of scientific revelation. A structure of scientific revolution. So I'm just going to read Sherry's comments. So this is good. So what Maimonides says, so this is, I think, important. This is like a little bit of an aside. But it's really interesting. I think it's worth it to appreciate Maimonides. So Maimonides makes a strong distinction. Propter quia is knowledge that, and propter quid is knowledge how, basically. So I'll give you an example. I could make this statement. I came up with this when I lived in New York. The New York subway runs late. Okay. Now, one way I could know that is whenever I leave my house, when Google Maps says that I can to get somewhere on time on the subway, I show up late. And therefore, I know the New York subway always runs late. That would work. But the problem with that statement is there's no understanding of a causal mechanism. It's just a restatement of the facts in a somewhat more elegant way. Then there's propter quid demonstration, which explains why. So I read the Village Voice article about how the signals are degraded and there's a culture of fear and drivers get tickets for going too fast, but the speed speedometers are broken, so the subway runs late. I understand, because of this bureaucratic morass of America's underinvestment in technology and infrastructure. Okay. That is very different than just traveling four or five times and knowing it's late. Now you don't understand why. So that's a propter quid explanation. So for Maimonides, as an Aristotelian, only propter quid explanations count as knowledge. So if I say my dog is warm, because he's always warm when I touch him, that's propter quid. If my dog is warm, okay, he's a mammal, and mammals maintain internal body temperature, and there's the reactions that happen, and it gives off heat and entropy, whatever. Okay, now you understand, right? So turns out to be a really, really important distinction for Maimonides. And there's a couple things that follow from it. So one is the Ptolemaic astronomy does not count as knowledge for Maimonides because it never explains why. It's just a mathematically elegant restatement of facts you've observed. And almost all of what we call science would not count as knowledge for Maimonides, right? The kind of empirically driven stuff that could have been otherwise. And so that's why it's partly, when we say Maimonides is reconciling science with the Torah, it's not really, because his category of knowledge is so different than our category of science. It's actually much closer to maybe even things about identity. We just know to be true and come from a very deep place. And then there's a second aside, which Maimonides actually doesn't make, but others do, that since true knowledge requires an understanding of causes, and God is uncaused, but is the cause of all creation. There's no such thing as knowledge of God. So that I just wanted to share, because I think your question about Maimonides is not basing himself off of Aristotelian science per se. Maimonides is basing himself off of the things that he knows to be true. Right? And then those have a high degree of overlap. Okay. So sorry, which part, Jerry, do you want to run by? I just talked for like 10 minutes.
Just before you made that last statement, the time it took me to type that out, it was...
Right. Well, because God is uncaused, and to know something means to understand its causes. So there's no knowledge of God possible. you can maybe observe certain facts about to understand something is to understand how it came to be, and you can't and why it is that way. And those kinds of statements can't be made about that.
So you can't know God; you can only believe in Him.
Exactly. Which then I just want to point out that we mentioned this different times. The beginning of the Mishnah Torah, when Maimonides says it's a mitzvah to know, he says, interestingly, that there is a God, but not to know God, because you can't know God. Really, really. I mean, it's very stark, very kind of aesthetic. Okay, we got to read this last part of Maimonides because it's awesome. Go for it.
There is a third group. Its members are so few in number that it is hardly appropriate to call them a group, except in the sense in which one speaks of the sun as a group or species, of which it is the only member. He would have been.
So my mind's like, it's just me, guys. I'm totally alone here. One time I was doing kind of trying like a queer reading of Maimonides out with a group that included a Sfara faculty member, Monica Gummery. And I said, do you buy this? And Monica said, I don't really know, because Maimonides is so lonely and the queer community is so awesome. It's an amazing moment. Like all the kind of episodes that was, but the difference you felt, I felt like it was such a redemptive moment for the Jewish community. There's an amazing Jewish queer community, but Maimonides is so alone. Okay, let's keep going.
This group consists of men whom the greatness of our sages is clear. They recognize the superiority of their intelligence from their words, which point to exceedingly profound truths. Even though this third group is few and scattered, their books teach the perfection which was achieved by the authors and the high level of truth which they had attained. Members of this group understand that the sages knew as clearly as we do the difference between the impossibility of the impossible and the existence of that which must exist. They know that the sages did not speak nonsense, and it is clear to them that the words of the sages contain both an obvious and a hidden meaning. Thus, whenever the sages spoke of things that seem impossible, they were employing the style of riddle and parable, which is the method of truly great thinkers. For example, the greatest of our wise men, Solomon, began his book by saying, to understand an analogy and a metaphor, the words of the wise and their riddles. All students of rhetoric know that the real concern of a riddle is with its hidden meaning and not with its obvious meaning, as, let me now put forth a riddle to you. Since the words of the sages all deal with supernatural matters, which are ultimate, they must be expressed in riddles and analogies. How can we complain if they formulate their wisdom in analogies and employ such figures of speech as are easily understood by the masses, especially when we note that the wisest of all men did precisely that, under the guidance of the Holy Spirit? I have in mind Solomon in Proverbs, the Song of Songs, and parts of Ecclesiastes. It is often difficult for us to interpret words and to deduce their true meaning from the form in which they are contained, so that their real inner meaning conforms to the reason and corresponds with the truth. This is the case even with the Holy Scriptures. The sages themselves interpreted scriptural passages in such a way as to deduce their inner meaning from the literal sense, correctly considering these passages to be figures of speech, just as we do. Examples are their explanations of the following passages. He smote two altar heaths of Moab. He went down also and slew a lion in the midst of a pit. Oh, that one would give me water to drink of the well of Bethlehem. Entire narrative of which these passages are a part was interpreted metaphorically. Similarly, the whole book of Job was considered by many of the sages to be properly understood only in metaphoric terms. The dead bones of Ezekiel, who were also considered by one of the rabbis to make sense only in the metaphorical terms. Similar treatment was given to other passages of this sort.
So I just want to pause here and point out two significant things. One is Maimonides is making the case that he should read the rabbis' stories as metaphor, because the rabbis, and therefore the rabbis were writers of metaphor, because the rabbis read the Torah as metaphor. And what's critical about the story, the killing the lion in the pit, etc., is that that story is not in need of metaphoric interpretation. It's the story of Samson. Right, it's not just that metaphor, and this is going to become the critical thing, becomes a kind of in case of emergency break here that you only apply narrowly at certain places. It becomes a broad interpretive methods, the genre of what you're reading is different than what it seems to say. Does that make sense? Not you just apply it locally here and there. It actually is what you are looking at. Right? The Book of Job also doesn't need to be read metaphorically.
Now, if you, reader, belong to either of the first two groups, pay no attention to my words nor to anything else in this section. You will not like it. On the contrary, it will irritate you and you will hate it. How could a person who is accustomed to eating large amounts of harmful food find simple food in small quantities appealing, even though they are good for him? On the contrary, he will actually find them irritating and he will hate them. Do you not recall the reaction of the people who were accustomed to eating onions, garlic, fish, and the like? They said, now our soul is dried away. There is nothing at all. We have not saved this manna to look to. But if you belong to the third group, when you encounter a word of the sages which seems to conflict with reason, you will pause, consider it, and realize that this utterance must be a riddle or a parable. You will sleep on it, trying anxiously to grasp its logic and its expression, so that you may find its genuine intellectual intention and lay hold of direct faith, as scripture says, to find out words of delight and that which was written uprightly, even words of truth. If you consider my book in this spirit, with the help of God, it may be useful to you.
Right. He's not aiming to be on the bestseller list. And I think, you know, part of you could just turn off the screen here because we're at the end. This is Maimonides. And I think there's really this opens, in some ways, it answers the question, what do? You read metaphorically, you read literarily. It also really doesn't answer, because there's a lot of questions about how do you read metaphor, right? Is the point just to, and there's kind of, I'll put out two different options, which I think the second one is right, but I haven't presented you with any evidence of that. Right? One is that the story is supposed to contain a packet of truth. It's just not a packet of truth about the facts of the story. Does that make sense? Like, there's a lesson, a moral, theological thing, which is just there. You just have to kind of decode it, and then you get it, and you can carry it with you. That's, I think, not what my body is saying. There's a second option, which is that the work doesn't contain a kernel of, you know, truth that you can pack up with you and carry away, but it's the act of the reading it and the thinking through it that is where its meaning occurs. You know, and part of my evidence for this is we haven't looked at this very important text in this genre, where Maimonides, in the introduction to the guide, describes the experience of truth as like a person walking in the dark who sees to whom a flash of lightning occurs in the heavens above, and for a moment the landscape is illuminated, and then it goes dark again. And right, what it shows you is that when you get truth, like he's describing, it's not like, oh, now I have a packet of truth that I carry around with me forever. It's that something occurs to you in a process, thing that in some ways changes everything, and then it vanishes again. Right? When you go outside of that process thing, it's not actually the same type of knowledge. It's not like we just substitute, oh, I thought I was gonna learn geology, biography, and history, and instead I'm learning metaphysical facts. That would be a direct substitution of the first way of reading. It's actually the reason that things are written in riddles, and he says in many places, is because you cannot express theological truth in straightforward prose and propositions. It can only be expressed in a literary partial way, right, where the reader has to kind of take an active part in imagining and working. So this is, you know, in some ways, this is the beginning. Now we're going to do some of this work together next week as we wrap up. But I just wanted to show you, this is in some ways Maimonides making good on the perplexity. And this is what the entirety of the guide is, right? The guide starts with this perplexity and then begins from there. Well, so right, interestingly, Maimonides doesn't really think this is true of the legal passages, right? And there, you can go back to the beginning of what we did today. They contradict in a lot of places, but you can reconcile them, right? And you should reconcile them. You should try to. There's a long tradition of doing just that. Whereas that's not the case, he thinks, for the theological ones.